Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I can do it.
Welcome to Radio Free Brooklyn. You're listening to Objection to the Rule. Today we are having a special guest. Please speak up and tell us your name.
Hi, I'm Kathy Rivera.
And who do you represent?
Myself.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Hi. We're also going to be talking about the government shutdown, reopen, and now we will have a new spending bill at least through the next month. But this one gives a big boost to the military budget while kicking the can on DACA. We'll discuss this in details. Plus, the Winter Olympics opened with a unified Korean delegation, and even talks between the two countries will develop into something more. And today we're also joined, as we just mentioned, by a guest to talk about their experiences and struggles as a caretaker for her dad. You're listening to Objection to the Rule live on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Okay. So first we're going to talk about the Olympics. The Olympics are underway in Pyeongchang, South Korea, but it's not just the athletes making news at right now. An historic meeting between the two Korean states is making headlines, as well as an invitation to South Korea to visit North Korea. North Korean official and the sister of Kim Jong-un, Kim Yo-jung, represented North Korea at the ceremonies and in a meeting with President Moon Jae-in. She's the first high-ranking official to enter South Korea since the war. The two leaders met for several hours in what's been reported as a positive interaction, while a team of North Koreans entered South Korea to participate on a unified Korean Olympic delegation, complete with band and cheerleaders. Critics are saying that the talks of peace and unification may still be a distraction, and that any diplomatic talks must encourage North Korean denuclearization. So, what do you guys think are the aims of this meeting? Rosie, do you think that it's just a distraction, or do you think we've got some real possibilities for unification?
You know what? I think that I said this on a few episodes ago when we first received the news that North Korea was going to come to the Olympics in South Korea. And what I really think is happening is I think they've realized that they can't really be successful continuing on the diplomacy they're on. And I think that they've realized the best way to upset the United States of America is to drive a wedge between them and South Korea, their ally. And South Korea it is their wish that their neighbors would not be aggressive to them, because it's a constant fear to them. And anything they can do to prevent aggression with their neighbor that doesn't require them selling them their souls, I think they are open to listening to. And the United States has done everything it can to try to prevent that, and to also warn South Korea, and to also to not believe that North Korea is sincere. And the sister of Kim Jong-un came with an invitation to South Korea's leader to come and speak to the supreme leader of North Korea. Now, while I still understand that North Korea engages in a lot of human rights issues and they are an aggressive power, I think that they're trying a different way of approaching their own agenda, because they're also cut off from the rest of the world. The only person that's sending stuff to them is China, and that's basically just rice and a few small luxuries. And I think that they need to connect with South Korea in order to survive. Mm-hmm. And one of the telling things, though, that I'll just include is that the North Koreans are not watching the Olympics, which I found to be an incredible disappointment, because I thought for certain that they would be having the Olympics, at least the parts that the North Koreans are involved in, broadcasted. Right. But instead, in North Korean TV, they are showing patriotic songs, marches, parades, and the normal state TV and radio that they have. So they don't even have access to what's going on. I don't even know if they realize what's going on beyond their border.
Yeah, I find that very interesting and a bit telling also, the fact that North Koreans aren't seeing this. You know, I have to wonder to myself personally, part of this, we know North Korea loves a good display, and is Kim Jong-un sending his sister in? It's a display, but by doing this during the Olympics, the entire world is seeing it, except North Korea. And you know, so it's one of these, like, are we making it a point to do this now to show the world, hey, we're not what, you know, some of you think we are. We're not, you know what I mean? It could be a little bit of part of the propaganda machine, but also, speaking of the propaganda machine, by not allowing North Korea, by not making visible to North Korean citizens the Olympic Games, that allows the government to spin a whole other story about what's actually really happening.
Right.
Which is, it's kind mm-hmm. of, it's par for the course with them. But I got to wonder if part of this is like they don't want their own people to know that we're engaging like in these displays of diplomacy. I don't know what people's thoughts are on that.
Right, right. It's interesting because it's hard to argue that it's not just a performance on the part of North Korea if they're simply, if it's one-sided, if their own people can't see it, but they want, it's so important to them that they are a part of this. And it also, I think Rachel makes a good point. It's hard to continue to sell one narrative, one closed narrative to their people if the people can see outside and see what other people are doing. Any thoughts, Kathleen, our guest?
I honestly haven't.
Okay.
Great.
Ori?
On the phones.
Hey, everyone. I think it's really interesting how captivated people have been with this story. I mean, even outside of the Olympics themselves, which typically are a big international thing, it kind of takes the energy and the attention of a lot of the world. This has been a central part of this story, this unification process between North Korea and South Korea and what it will result in. I kind of agree with some of the things that have been mentioned. It's really odd that the people of North Korea don't have access to view this. So it's almost like the narrative is being formed for the rest of the world, and then it's being painted a different way to the people of North Korea. And if you've seen some of the state announcements about this, you know, it kind of speaks to this idea that they're not necessarily trying to be as diplomatic or as forward-thinking or open as we tend to paint it here in the West, in media in the West. So it'll be interesting to see what happens after the flame is burned out, and after the games are closed, how these discussions unfold.
Right. That's a good point. Do we think that the only path to unification between the two Koreas and the larger international community can come through demilitarization? Is that one of those red lines we hear about a lot? Rachel?
I'm not sure how you can have that unification without some level of demilitarization, given how militaristic the culture is in North mm-hmm. Korea. But I'm trying to think of other examples of unification, and I think, or you know, collapse of like these kind of regimes, you know, access to information and exchange of ideas, I think, was a big part of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Think of the glasnost policy. And I'm sure there was some demilitarization happening too, but a lot of that was information and openness and mm-hmm. more, trade that played culture, information, economics played a large role in that. You know, when we think of the German reunification, I think there were economic pressures, a lot of that. Both sides had to say, okay, we're going to physically knock down this wall. We're ready for this. We're done. But I think economic pressures tend to be a big part of this. I don't know if it can only come through demilitarization. Clearly, there have to be some other things going on there. Some other ingredients in the pot, but I imagine some demilitarization should need to happen because North Korea is just so mm-hmm. That's what they put out there. They're so about the parades and the military and the police.
Well, now we are
that,
too.
Yeah.
Right?
Well. Yeah.
Yeah. I was about to say, can we really draw that line in the sand?
We'd have to step up to the plate ourselves. We can't be like, guns are pointed at you, now put yours down. You know, it wouldn't work.
Right. Yeah, you make a good point about openness policies as opposed to demilitarization. Like, we have different standards, right, for the people we consider our friends having huge destructive weaponry versus people we don't. We need Iran and we need North Korea to denuclearize and to stop all production. But, you know, ally countries, we don't have the same concerns. Rose?
No, I think that's a really good point, for sure, that there's these rules, these double rules for the countries that, you know, we are friends with and ones that have we've not enjoyed this more negative animosity with. We want to control them and control their ability to protect themselves. And we have the largest military installation as the United States around the world. We have bases all over the world. And there are no calls for any reduction or removal of that. In fact, we're, you know, we've just put a lot more money towards defense. So is it kind of hypocritical? It seems to ask of this, shouldn't be looking for like a global demilitarization, should we look at, you know, building peace through that method where all countries look to reduce those harmful forces? You know, I'm not sure, but it is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Next up on our news discussion is the budget. After an overnight shutdown on Friday morning, a new spending bill was finally passed and signed through Congress. And it's going to go through March 23rd. It'll include a big boost to government spending, and it's reported to push the deficit over $1 trillion in 2019. So the spending bill didn't make any concession on DACA, much to the chagrin of Democrats. But Trump and Ryan are promising that talks will come. It also adds $300 billion in additional spending, which is split between defense and health, infrastructure, and other costs, according to Reuters. The bill will extend government borrowing authority until after the midterm elections, and it includes funding for abstinence-only education, according to the NY Times, which is something to get used to. So I'm curious what you guys think. Will we see a resolution on DACA and immigration coming out of any of this? Because it keeps getting pushed down the line, and it's not being addressed. What do you guys think?
I think we also keep seeing these shutdowns occur. So I think eventually we will be pressed to sort of make some kind of deal on it. Is anyone concerned about the deficit anymore? Do people care about that? That, like, because it's a huge, huge number. And when you're walking through Union Square, you can see that ticker just sort of counting up and up and up and up. And it's like almost, it's just like an intangible
right.
amount.
We're numb to that. That yeah. ticker's been going.
It's been going.
I don't think people understand what is the consequences, what is the reality. They see the ticker, they see the numbers, and I don't think that they fully understand what it means when our deficit is that large. They don't understand the actual result of that. And they just see that we have debt. And lots of people in this country carry debt, and they don't understand what it means when your country is carrying debt. And I think that is part of the problem. And I also think that part of it is the legislators have engaged in incredible amounts of irresponsibility. It's not to say that the extra spending bill that was added was a big mistake. I think that the whole thing is a big mistake. The tax bill plus the extra spending, all of it have amounted to what will approach to be a great tragedy. We are going to be in severe debt all over again, which was something that we had to deal with before.
Right. Yeah. I think there are parallels between household debt that a lot of Americans are dealing with or not dealing with and, you know, domestic debt that's much larger. You know, in both situations, we're given the narrative that, you know, you're in debt temporarily, but then you're going to make up for it by what you earn as a country or as an individual, that it's okay to put things on cards or to put things on your deficit because the growth is going to overcome it.
Yeah, it's I think also part of that narrative, which I think is a bit of a false narrative. If you work hard enough, it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. We live in this. Our society is such now, at least in, like, I would say New York City is an example of, as a part of the country where expectations are absurd. You know, the rents are so high. How does one survive without maybe, you know, going into debt? Because and the government's kind of functioning at that level too. Maybe we need to rethink what is normal, the way certain economic aspects of our society is structured. Like, no, certain things, we're going into debt because things cost that much. Certain things that you need a roof over your head, and you need to eat food, cost that much. Why do they cost that much? Maybe we got to look at the system. Some of these problems are really systemic, like things like food costs, transportation costs, and you can get to the root of it.
Look at the big debt that a lot of Americans have, myself included, student loan debt.
Yes.
I mean, amassing amounts of student loan debt, which the writing on the wall is that, what the narrative that we're taught is that you incur this debt and it's an investment in your future, and then you'll get that great job after college and you'll start paying and paying and paying. And 30 years later, hopefully you've brought down the debt to enough where they'll wipe it away. But there are so many people that aren't paying their debt or can't pay their debt or can't afford their student loan payment. And, you know, these types of things are causing us, I think, to that numbness that you were speaking of earlier, of to the debt. You know, we know we owe all this money. So what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that, you know, we elected a government, we as the people elected this government, who wanted to curtail spending, that wanted to not frivolously waste money, not, you know, put a lot of debt on the nation. But here we have this spending bill that's incurring $300 billion. Like, it's like Austin Powers money.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, you know, the just the enormous amounts. And I don't want to get into the debate on whether or not we need more military spending. You know, there are many, you know, people working hard in the military. There's, you know, they deserve to be paid. I believe in the country's need to protect itself to a certain extent. And then also the other infrastructure costs that we're paying for. So, you know, it's not necessarily if the debt's valid. But then I guess there is that big question of, is the debt valid, and what is it going to, and who do we owe as a country?
We definitely need to spend more money on military parades, though.
Oh, yeah. That's not up for debate.
You gotta look at, you know, certain things you have to spend money on. Like, I feel the government should be spending money on, and I think they're the sort of things that individuals, like as an individual, I need to spend money on. If I need, you know, medical care, yeah, I got to make sure that I, you know, I'm asthmatic. I got to take my medicine every day. Food, shelter. Yeah. And I think things like that, I think, don't cut spending for things like the ACA. Don't do that. But you might, you know, rather than going there, and maybe you need to look at what prevents people from being able to earn or spend money that goes into the economy. The idea, like, you know, I think this ridiculous retweet by Paul Ryan's a great example of, you know, it's like, hey, you know, this one woman had he retweeted something someone had tweeted, basically, like, and apparently she responded to a Twitter poll. She's saying, you know, how much are you seeing anything in your tax and your extra in your checks as a result of the Republican tax cut, and what can you do with that money? And it was the equivalent of like $50 a year this woman's getting,
or like, so, like 15 like, cents per paycheck.
Yeah, so it's like, and the thing is, it's kind of like, instead of just slashing, you know, taxes, and you know, $50 doesn't do much for, you know, $5,000 a year. That will make a difference on most people's lives. But instead of like thinking, I'm going to cut taxes and that's going to be great for everyone, because look at all this other expendable income they have now, which, what, $50 a year? But then we're not going to provide certain services or keep in place programs that make medicine, food, shelter, education accessible. That we got to rethink that a little bit. We got to, you know, provide certain things, but then, you know, consider how do we, you know, tackle student loan debt. Yeah, that'd be a great. I've read a few articles. There are economic theorists who you know, they put out, they're like, hey, this could actually stimulate the economy in major ways. You know, if we put into place certain student loan debt forgiveness program. So I think we've got to rethink, like, you know, how to save money, you know, definitely, as a country, or those making these budget decisions do.
Yeah. And, you know, like, there's a lot of value in social services that we're not taking into account. You know, when you have an employment package by a traditional employer, they'll give you a certain salary and they'll give you certain health benefits and transportation and other benefits. And those, the value of those benefits would be a much higher salary. So when we're cutting benefits to Americans and we're raising their, you know, so-called paycheck through lower taxes, they're not necessarily making up for what's lost.
Right.
So now we can have a chance to talk about the memos. Oh, the memos. Release the memos. What about the memos? After a GOP memo on Russia was finally declassified by President Trump against the wishes of many, Trump held, including the FBI and Democrats, Trump held off on declassifying a Democratic response to that memo, citing that it includes sensitive information. The Democrats issued a response to the memo released by the GOP, and their response accused the FBI of abusing authority on its investigation of campaign officials. The memo was reviewed by the FBI and the Department of Justice officials, and it was found to have reportedly contained sensitive material which could hinder law enforcement and weaken national security. Similar claims were made about the memo released on February 2nd by the GOP leaders, but the memo was released anyway. The White House is saying that it's inclined to release the memo if changes are made. So what do you guys think about that? Do you think that the decision by Trump to release one memo but not the other was purely partisan, or are we looking at inequality and sensitivity of information?
Any thoughts on that?
I can't figure out what the major issue with this. I feel like this memo is all about Trump creating a distraction. He's so amazing at it. Like, you know, the porn star pops up just when something is about to happen to him and he needs to divert, like, everyone from what he's actually doing. And I think that if you notice, this is coinciding with the Mueller investigation honing closer and closer to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes is it Rosenberg, the justice, the judge?
Brad Rosenberg.
Yeah. He's being directly called out on this, and he is one of the people, he's the person that's between Trump and Mueller. So in order for Trump to get Mueller, he has to get, you know, this one person. And it's so coincidental that as Mueller is just has requested him to come and answer questions, this suddenly surfaces and it's trying to incriminate the one person that would keep him from firing Mueller and also would put a cloud around this investigation. So to me, it's like, I don't care if the Democrats' memo comes out. I feel to myself that I see this release of the Republican memo for what it is. Mm-hmm. It's just another thing to distract me from the serious business that's going on.
Right.
I think he likes controlling information, thinks that's what he's doing here. But I'll release this much and not that one. And this, I mean, we don't know what was in these things. Because it was information that was classified. We don't know originally, and I don't know. I think it's a distraction thing. I think it's also, I think he likes to feel like he's controlling the flow of information, and in some ways he is by saying, I'll let this one out, but not that one. And yes, it's partisan, clearly. Right. You know, his own party said, you know, maybe don't release this. But this other one from the other side of the aisle, yeah, he just decides right away, I'm not going to release it, you know, and he does that anyway. It's partisan. I think he's just trying to control flow of information.
And one thing that I was listening to NPR and they had, they had an expert talk about the process of being able to get permission to perform surveillance on an American. And the process is not that easy. You don't show up and say, hey, I'm going to watch this person. You have to have evidence. It's not that easy to get. And so they were talking about the fact that if they were surveilling an American, that they have to go through this rigorous process in order to get the ability to do that. And that if they were able to present this sort of information, it would be the responsibility of the judge to allow it. And Also, there was an issue around Nunes himself. You know, he has been implicated in, hasn't he been implicated in the Russia investigation mm-hmm. somehow? Yeah. And he's also has had issues as part of the ethics committee. Mm-hmm. And so it's as all this is happening, I feel like Nunes is already like a tainted person with a tainted memo. And I don't know why we're even paying attention right. as a yeah. country and why we'd even bother to release it. It just I'm astounded every day as a country. We become more and more absurd. And I don't know when the levee will break and we'll just will there be chaos or will everyone be arrested?
I guess that's the logical conclusion to this conversation.
I'll have to keep watching The Simpsons to find out, because apparently they called this whole thing 20 years ago or something.
Right.
Well, we've seen so much obstructionism, you know, and I feel like we're at this point where we are looking at what the government is doing on both sides and all sides and trying to figure out what are the goals beyond the goals. There's like several levels of like, you know, I don't know if I want to call it strategy or activity that's happening. And I feel like we're at this point where everything has to be analyzed for the ulterior motive.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So we're going to take a break. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Kathleen, who's undertaking care of her father. So we'll discuss her experience with her family and her experience with New York social systems and what's in place right now for elder care. But first, let's take a listen to some music from Dietra, one of the bands that's going to play in our March Music Showcase, which is RFB Presents First Thursdays at the Well on March 1st. You're listening to Objection to the Rule on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Just blame one more in bed with me tonight. I taste the blood, the pulse it dies. I've turned and watched the bodies pile. Cause I need to free the hollow walls inside of me. Won't you show a beating heart? I live this life to take from you. Don't you go into the dark. Your soul will cry beyond the howling of the moon. Won't you show a beating heart?
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule. That was Dietra. Make sure to come out and hear them live at our monthly music showcase, RFB Presents First Thursdays at the Well. This month it's on March 1st at the Well, which is at 272 Mesereau Street in Brooklyn. Tickets are $8 in advance online or $10 at the door. Now let's get back to our next segment. Aging is something that happens to all of us, if we're lucky. We all get to a certain point and we find the effects of age on our bodies and our minds. For some of us, who takes care of us when we age is a real problem, and it's something we don't all think about. Here in the studio with us today is Kathleen, who's had to answer this question a lot earlier than a lot of us would have otherwise or care to. Kathleen, thank you for joining us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Kathleen, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
You know, I'm one of those artsy types, musician, writer. And my day job, I work in one of like a notable music archive in New York.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Cool. What kind of music do you do?
Me, it's like poetry rock. Maybe word rock might be a good genre to create.
Great. I'm interested.
Thank you.
And can you tell us a little bit about your caretaking experience? You've been taking a lot of the share of the care for your dad.
I mean, yeah. So my dad is a Latino gentleman in his 70s now. And he's super active. Lived a really full life, did a whole bunch of different jobs. He was he did prison outreach and like Bible study in prisons, and he was in the army. He was a machinist that kind of traveled around Latin America repairing machines for a company and worked for the city for many, many years. So super active, always did projects around the house. The last project he did, he actually replaced the entire front porch of the house by hand, which is like, I don't even know how someone does that, but he did. But then in 2009, he came down with this semi-rare condition called Guillain-Barré, which affects the immune system of the body. And so the immune system starts attacking the nerve endings and actually causes kind of like a neurological disorder. The signals aren't sent between the nerves and the body ends up being incapable of moving. But then you also think about like all the other processes in the body. Like your heart is a muscle, you know, everything works with your nerves. So it's been difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old were you when that happened in 2009?
I was just starting college.
Uh-huh.
I was probably like 18, 19. And yeah, it was really surprising. He ended up falling down the stairs one day. And he fractured a rib. And when we went to the hospital, they did a spinal tap. They discovered this enzyme. Mm-hmm. And it was the marker for Guillain-Barré.
And when he went to the hospital and they did the spinal tap, how did the diagnosis and how did the treatment play out in the beginning?
Well, there's a couple of treatments for Guillain-Barré. Mm-hmm. And they said that there was an option for like IVIG, intravenous immunoglobulin treatment. And ultimately he didn't receive it when he was at that hospital. And he's never received treatment for this illness.
How come?
The cost is too high for the insurance that he has.
Wow.
And It's a two-pronged assault, actually. It's that the insurance agency doesn't want to pay for the treatment. And the hospital record keeping these days is so poor that there's almost no communication between hospitals. So if he gets tested and it comes up like he has Guillain-Barré, another hospital won't get that report. And therefore, they'll say like, oh, it's some kind of spinal injury or something like that. And they'll just write it off like that.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's happened to your family?
That has happened, yes.
That's so rough. And it's a factor of the insurance, and it's also a factor of what the hospitals are willing to do and to diagnose?
Definitely. I mean, since it's an immunological disorder, there's a lot of stuff that comes along with it. He'll get a flu very easily, and that flu will cause a relapse of the illness because the body's immune system is like supercharged and angry after getting the flu. And then they'll just kind of treat the flu. They won't treat that he's having a flare up of Guillain-Barré. They'll just say he's paralyzed, you know, he's bedbound, and he also has the flu.
And that's a factor of costs.
Definitely, I would say.
And how has this affected your life and your family, these challenges?
I mean, like 100% different. Mm-hmm. Especially my father being so active before, that kind of energy in the house was always a huge factor. I have, you know, two siblings that are married, have children, live in other states, mm-hmm. or, you know, live farther away in New York. And so they're not able to really be as present as my mother and I. And my mother is also, you know, approaching her 70s now. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult position for her to be in. And it's also a difficult position for me to be in, being someone in my 20s, where society is telling you that you should be going out and traveling and seeing the world and, you know, getting that competitive job that keeps you there from 8 to 9, you know, that's not a possibility for me right now, because he is at home and we care for him at home.
Right. So how does that helping out in that caretaking position play out for you within your family?
I mean, I would say it took a lot of trial and error to see what was possible. You know, when I was in school, I decided I would take a lot of time off to sort of be home and be helping mom. And we were both pretty scared at that point. You know, neither of us really understood what this illness was. And we both needed like the moral support to get through. So we were like the buddy system, you know, you get through it, you stay home. And now, because, you know, it stands to reason that in your 20s, you have just put down roots and stuff like that. My mother has been more willing and more understanding of the fact that I, you know, need to have this full-time job. I need to have these experiences in my life. So we break it into shifts. She'll take like the morning shift, which starts super early in the morning with medication and, you know, cleaning and changing of bed linens. And I'll, during that time, I'll go to work and I'll come back in the afternoon, you know, after lunch, and do the sort of like the entertainment hour, where it's like music therapy and watching old movies and new movies when they're good. And, you know, just sort of keeping his mind as active as possible. And then there's more medication and more cleaning and, you know, maybe a shave and a haircut and whatever. And then we're probably getting to bed at around 1 a.m. So it starts from like 6 with my mother and then we're in at 1.
And between all that, you weave in all of the other parts of your life, your job, your music, and
that's
social life.
Somehow, I'm very tired.
You're very tired.
but yeah, I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing right now. Yeah.
That's good. Do you think it's affected the way you see your life, but also the way you see everybody else's lives, to have this sort of split between your life as a 20-something and your life as a caretaker?
Yeah, sure. Because there are, well, I mean, there are some issues that arise in your 20s that I just think are like non-issues. Like, you know, people can like get angry about their jobs or, you know, get angry about social situations. And I'm like, you know, I've got it pretty good. Like, I understand the necessities of life, and for that I'm really, you know, it's good. I know that it's been an edifying experience in that regard.
May I interject with a quick question?
Run in.
Are home care attendants involved in your life?
It's a good question. His insurance, his VA medical insurance covers a nurse practitioner. And she comes to the house once a month to give him a checkup. But other than that, any insurance that we have will only cover nursing for about a month.
What would happen if he didn't have a wife or any children and that he was by himself? What would be what would happen?
Okay, well, usually what they say the best course of action would be to go on Medicaid, which would take a lawyer to come in and file all of this paperwork. Certain lawyers specialize in this. It can cost upwards of $10,000 to get all of this work done. And then he would be in a nursing home full time with a credit card that would have like a few hundred dollars on it for private spending. But, you know, on top of that, the nursing facilities these days in New York are overcrowded and understaffed.
So the VA insurance is not sufficient to actually provide care for him, is what you're saying?
I would say that neither insurance is fully sufficient. He has, you know, some private insurance due to his work as for the state, for New York State. But yeah, neither insurance is willing to give him a year-long nursing care or physical therapy. Or any of those really important things. And even, you know, the VA also offers, they should offer like house modifications for people who have severe physical impairments. But for his case, they've refused to as well.
How long has he been in this condition?
it's been a declination. So he got sick in 2009. It's 2018 right now, about 9 years, 10 years. And it's only gotten progressively worse.
Yeah, sorry, that was my next question. So he's gotten progressively worse then.
Yeah, that's right. And there are certain things I would wish that insurance would cover, especially physical therapy. That's a huge deal. But, you know, it's just not in the budget, I guess, for some reason.
Right. Coming up after the break, we're going to hear more from Kathleen about how caring for her father has affected her life and her family's life. But right now we're going to listen to a little more Deatra. So we'll be back shortly from Objection to the Rule live on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome back to Radio Free Brooklyn's Objection to the Rule. Make sure to check out all of our shows on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com or take us everywhere by downloading the Radio Free Brooklyn app, which is available on iTunes and Google Play. Now let's continue our conversation with Kathleen. Welcome back, Kathleen.
Hey.
Hey. So I'm curious to hear why your family is choosing to care for your dad. Why is this something that's happening at home rather than a full-time care facility?
Well, I mean, first off, we're the kind of family that the dynamic is that, like, no person is left behind. So we would always choose to keep him at home and make him as comfortable as we can, and certainly make sure that his health and, like, medical care is taken care of, you know, do a good job of that. In addition to that, though, you know, we've had experiences where he went to rehab facilities. This was back when he could actually, you know, hold up his own weight and maybe walk a little bit. And the insurance that he had at that time would not cover more than, I think, 3 months at a time he could stay at these rehab facilities. And so it was always bouncing around from place to place, from treatment to treatment. And we always found that he got the best and most dedicated amount of care at home. Mm-hmm. I'm in constant awe and admiration of people who work in nursing home facilities and in hospitals because of, you know, the shoestring sort of budgets that they deal with, the understaffing that they deal with, and the constant demand that they deal with as well.
And the patients, they have to deal with people who might look down upon them or disrespect them.
Yeah, definitely.
Or who are feeling their own pain and can't think about anyone else's pain.
That's right. It's a heavy, heavy job to take on. And I've met a lot of really fantastic nurses and doctors. But at the same time, it does cause a burnout in some individuals where they just sort of give up and they neglect their duties and they neglect the patients. And you see that, you see the effects on patients.
I have a question. Obviously, money is always a factor in why services are denied. but knowing, hearing what you're saying about your dad, has there's insurance he had from work and also the VA. So there are some resources there from which he and the family can pull from. Do you think part of why the denial for like really effective therapies, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that this isn't a diagnosis that's very well known? Do you think it's I don't know if it's technical. There is a technical category of rare diseases. Mm-hmm. And many of them are things you never heard of, unless maybe you have something like cystic fibrosis had, Boomer Esiason and the football player got behind it in certain organization. We know the term and we know about cystic fibrosis now, but that's because somebody with some fame and some clout got behind it and has done a lot of wonderful work. But, you know, you forget that that's actually technically a rare disease. I don't know if this is technically a rare disease. Do you think lack of information and therefore study has anything to do with why he's getting, you know,
I think
eye treatments?
I think it certainly plays a part. I've kind of followed it for a while. Early on, doctors, when we would talk to them, had little to no experience with this illness. And as time has progressed, it seems like it seems like the information is getting out there and that people are learning more and more about it. So, I mean, that's certainly one, and like Guillain-Barré is not a household like topic. Not like polio was back in the day or something like that. It could be that I would want to believe that when you like the insurance was looking over my father's, chart, if there is a chart anymore, I'm not even sure if they keep these files as well as they should, because it seems like every time we go to a hospital, they have forgotten his history somewhere along the line. Uh-huh. They only keep the files for like a year or something like that. I would want to believe that they would treat him just as sort of like, you know, a person with impaired mobility, because he can pick up and use his arms and legs, but he can no longer sustain his own weight and walk. I want to believe that they would just treat the symptoms of the illness and not the illness itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's obvious that this is a result of a larger picture, that there is a broken system that you're having to deal with and sacrifice as a result. What, in your opinion, do you think would need to happen in order for your father to be properly cared for and for you to be able to manage more easily his care, which is something that you have volunteered to do? Even though he is your father, you are volunteering to do this. It's not a requirement.
Mm-hmm. I feel like
there is a certain amount of like legal representation that a person needs when dealing with their insurance companies all the time. Because the amount of work it takes to communicate with an agency like that is mind numbing and almost, it's just an almost an impossibility at times.
It's how they make their money.
That's right. That's right. And then, you know, they like bury their mistakes. They don't have to worry about someone coming back from the dead and bringing all this evidence with them. They have that assurance that eventually their problems solve themselves. They don't have to pay and they can wait it out.
All right. We're running out of time. So Kathleen, I'd like to hear what you would like to tell people about elder care and what you think that people, younger people should know about.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to come down and talk about it today is that I find that a lot of young people are dealing with this now. I have many, many friends that are caregivers for their family members, be it parents or grandparents. I think that I just think that it's a huge issue. There's a whole, it's a broken system, and it's a pharmaceutical industry that's taking advantage of people's good faith that they'll be taken care of when they're older. But it's something that we really have to fight for. Mm-hmm. All of these distractions that are going on in the news, they're distractions because these industries make money off of people and don't want to be talked about and don't want to be, you know, noticed. So focus on the important issues and be really understanding for caregivers and their families. To caregivers and their families.
Thank you.
2 minutes.
Thank you. Where can we follow you, Kathleen? Where can we hear more about your music work?
I have a band out right now. We're called Doctor for the time being. If you want to follow us on Instagram, we're at DrBandBK, and you can follow me too, Kathleen_ETC at Instagram.
What kind of music do you play?
I really love Patti Smith. I'm all about words and poetry and meaning and really loud rock and roll. So word rock, poet rock.
Great. If someone wanted to learn a little bit more about your dad's diagnosis, is there a place or a resource you might recommend, a website or an organization?
God. I would say, GBS Foundation actually has multiple chapters all over the country and annual meetings. So that's a really good place to go.
Great. Thank you so much, Kathleen. That's all for this week's Objection to the Rule. Make sure to follow us